Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want.
Give the people what they want. Your weekly movement news roundup.
You're with Give the People What They Want. This is our 170th show. It's May 9th, which is Victory Day, and I know Zoe is anxious to talk about that. Give the People What They Want is brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Zoe, you want to start off by telling us a little bit about Victory Day, an often forgotten day in world history?
Well, today is Friday, May 10th, but yesterday was Victory Day, May 9th, which commemorates the very important and heroic victory of the Red Army against Nazi Germany. If you grew up in the United States, you probably don't even know what Victory Day is, or probably don't even know that the Red Army actually was the key force which defeated Nazi Germany. You'd probably think that it was, D-Day and Normandy. But, you know, the Soviet Union actually paid the highest price in this fight against fascism, losing 27 million people, I believe, a significant portion of its population. In fighting Nazi Germany and the Axis powers, we put up some pretty interesting and cool content at People's Dispatch, highlighting also the efforts of the partisan groups of these, you know, national liberation militias formed by people who were taking a stand against the fascist occupation of their countries, of the collaboration between their national bourgeoisie and these fascist powers. You know, very brave and heroic resistance. And it's interesting that with, you know, 70 years of difference, we can look back and say, yes, they were so brave because they resisted fascism. And oftentimes when this same resistance is right in front of our faces, we're forced to condemn it. And if we don't condemn it, then maybe we suffer consequences. And I think people know exactly what I'm talking about. The resistance of the Palestinian people today, a lot of people are drawing these similar comparisons that they continue in this legacy of fighting a fascist system, a settler colonial project, which, again, a very, very a different sort of historical explanation of why of the Zionist project. Of course, it's not the same as the fascist project in Europe, but the resistance of the people and the will of the people to fight and to risk everything for their own liberation and for the possibility for their children to not live under occupation. I think that this will and this resistance and this determination is something that does carry over. And so, of course, on Victory Day, we remember the millions of people, not only in the Soviet Union who gave their lives, but also in China. People across the world were, of course, all impacted by World War II. And so, you know, an important day to remember, to try to fight the revisionism of history, but also to understand that resistance against fascism continues and that we shouldn't have to wait for decades to pass to be able to identify that the Palestinian people fighting against the Zionist project is just and it's righteous, and that, you know, these powers that attempt to impose these certain types of models, oppressive models, fascist models of society, will always be resisted by the people.
Yeah, I mean, and it's important to go right from that, Zoe, to the issue of what's happening in Rafah as we do our program. You know, we've focused on this genocidal campaign by the Israeli government ever since October. Of course, before that, we've covered the question of the Palestinians with great depth before that. 80,000 people among the nearly 1.5 million Palestinians who are in Rafah have moved out, have been doubly displaced. What's really quite tragic about the situation over the past week is first in Cairo, there was an indication of a peace agreement. So people who had been leaving Rafah going towards the Mediterranean Sea turned around to come back. And as they came back, the Israeli Air Force fired on those roads, in fact, killing people returning to Rafah from the coastal area, people who had just been celebrating, thinking that the ceasefire would hold. Hamas had agreed on a ceasefire agreement. Israel walked away from it. Now Hamas is saying, look, we don't want to revise the deal. We already made a deal. It's up to you to honor the deal. The United States government has threatened to stop supplies of weapons, saying that if you bomb Gaza, we will not send you the 2,000-pound bombs that they've been sending. These 2,000-pound bombs are lethal. They are exactly what enables the Israelis to take out entire neighborhoods. Parenthetically, the British government, Lord Cameron, the foreign minister of the government of Rishi Sunak, I should say, not government of Rishi Sunak, but the caretaker government, because recent elections in the United Kingdom showed immense gains by the Labour Party, defeat by the Conservatives. This sort of lame duck caretaker government of Rishi Sunak has said that they will not put any conditions and continue to supply the Israelis with weapons, even if they attack Rafah. Lord Cameron being pretty explicit about this. Biden, I think, interestingly, and I know you're going to talk about this next, but Biden has been under immense pressure, largely from this uprising by students in the United States. He made his speech under pressure. It's not the 40,000 plus Palestinians killed that motivates his concern. It's in fact the pressure coming from the protest movement within the United States. I think it's had a significant impact, made him say that if there is an attack on Rafah, they will suspend armaments. In fact, there has already been an attack on Rafah. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has been very straightforward about the fact of this attack in Rafah. So Mr. Biden's statement sounds now kind of hollow. Like, the attack has already happened. Why haven't you already said that you're going to stop weapons supplies and so on? While the United States has said this, interestingly and not unexpectedly, Benjamin Netanyahu has immediately condemned it and reacted with great anger, in fact, and said that the United States must support Israel all the way. And Netanyahu, in his classic form, said, if we have to stand alone, we will stand alone. I already said that we have to, we will fight with our fingernails. Well, in a sense, they really don't have to fight with their fingernails, because other people are continuing to supply them. United States has not stopped supplying, and the United Kingdom will keep supplying them. So I don't think there's going to be any question of Mr. Netanyahu's fingernails in the dirt having to do any of the fighting, but that's what he said. You see, it's interesting that all people who have been following the Cairo process, where the Hamas leadership has been coming in from Doha, Qatar, they talked to the Qataris and the Egyptians in Cairo. The Qataris and Egyptians, through shuttle diplomacy, go and talk to the Israelis. What's been pretty remarkable is the Egyptians and the Qataris have closed the gap, and they've closed the gap quite significantly. Hamas has made some concessions. The holdup right now is on the sequence of events. The Israelis are insisting that the prisoners be released first, and then they'll stop the bombing. The Hamas leadership is saying, first stop the bombing, and then we'll release the prisoners. This question of the timetable and sequence is holding some things up. But I'm actually of the view that this is not the actual issue. The actual issue is the Israelis have said it quite explicitly. They want to destroy Hamas completely. This is actually almost a futile effort, because, as I say, the Hamas leadership anyway is going to be outside Rafah. They are not there. And large parts of the Hamas fighters will be reconstructed pretty quickly. Saw that after 2014. So I think if the goal is, the maximalist goal is destruction of Hamas, then Mr. Netanyahu has set himself an impossible task. And then this war is going to continue to its exterminist end. which is actually very, very unfortunate that the peace proposal on the table, which the Israelis nominally agreed to, they've now shoved aside. This is a sign of very bad faith by the Israeli government in Tel Aviv. But of course, as the United States continues to dither on all this, protest movement continues in the U.S. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it is remarkable, and it has to be recognized that any concession that Biden has made is, of course, due to pressure. Because, again, the reason that the United States support Israel is because it's beneficial, is because they need their ally in that region. So it's not because they want Israel to be weaker that they're saying that they're going to suspend weapons shipments. It's truly because they're facing a political crisis in the United States. Not only has it been 6 months of protests, not only is it impossible for both Democratic and Republican lawmakers to speak anywhere publicly before they're interrupted and reminded how they have bankrolled and politically backed a genocide. But now, the student uprising has provoked a new wave of militant organizing, of just very engaged across the country in the very institutions that many of these lawmakers have even come out of and are seen as kind of these factories for State Department officials. We're talking about the George Washington University. This is many people who are going right into Washington coming out of this university, Harvard University, all of these elite establishments where the ruling class kind of breeds their successors are the same places that are now rising up and trying to take control over their campuses and demand that their administrations actually listen to them. We've covered this, of course, over the past several weeks, but this has actually really changed the equation. Many people have said it, but even more people are actually being brought into the movement because of the response of administrators and local authorities. So when people are seeing young students, the age of 18 years old, being brutalized by the police on their own college campus where they're actually paying tuition, it changes the equation for people. So we're seeing more people being brought in, more crises, more local authorities affected by these protests. And this, again, has created a situation where Biden actually has to change in some way, even if just in name, even if just in words, has to say, okay, I'm going to take some action because, you know, he can't deal with the level of protests. I mean, how many millions of dollars have different cities and states actually spent on policing these protests, on processing the 2,500 people, faculty, students, community members that have been arrested in the past 8 months, and especially, of course, in the past 3 weeks. I mean, it is, these numbers add up. And, you know, at this point, we are a couple of months away from elections. And as they say, every 4 years, these are the most important elections. This is crucial. But really, Biden has extremely low approval ratings. We saw that in the primaries, the birth or the growth of this uncommitted, the not endorsing Biden movement is not just a blip. This is unprecedented. These are people who are part of the Democratic Party voting base. We're not even talking about people who are perhaps not going to participate in the process. These are people who are committed Democrats who went to the primaries to say we don't support Biden. We have the DNC coming up at the end of August. There's going to, of course, be so many protests. And even if Biden, through his pressure, and hopefully this does happen, because we want this to happen, that if a ceasefire happened, people are not going to forget that he not only let a genocide happen for all of these months, but he actually supported it with his rhetoric, with sending weapons, with sending money, again, for over 7 months. And so people are not going to forget that. He's facing a crisis. The chance and the likelihood of him actually winning re-election is extremely slim. Extremely slim, because he seems to just shoot himself in the foot at every opportunity. So, he is faced with this challenge. He's trying to make concessions. Israel, of course, has its own internal contradictions, where you have the families of the hostages again, escalating their protests, getting even more angry as they see that really the end game, as you said, Vijay, is not, they don't have realistic military goals in mind. Defeating Hamas is not a realistic objective. As you said, attacking Rafah is not going to achieve this. So what they have in mind is actually not even getting the hostages back, because if they're going to completely annihilate the Gaza Strip, which is essentially the kind of language that Netanyahu is using, then they're also going to kill the hostages. And I think the families of the hostages are realizing that they are not willing to be collateral damage in this genocidal campaign. And so, you know, the tables are shifting, the contradictions are deepening, both within Israel and in its historic social base, the United States. But what they've realized is that they have to make some sort of adjustments, because if they continue as they were, they're going to continue to face backlash from their own people and people who, you know, historically would have supported them.
Yeah, quite right. You're listening to Give the People What They Want, brought to you from People's Dispatch today. That's Zoe. Normally, it's Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter. Last week in Hawaii, there was a defense summit, which was effectively hosted by the United States Pacific Command. And the main host was U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin. Now, this is interesting. Yes, there's a war going on in Ukraine. Yes, there is a genocidal campaign ongoing in Gaza. But that doesn't mean that the United States has taken its foot off the pedal to put pressure on China. You know, about a decade ago, the United States brought together neighboring countries in Asia, neighboring in the sense that they neighbor the kind of Asian arena around China. They are not neighbors of each other, but brought together India, Australia, and Japan into a formation known as the Quadrilateral Security Arrangement, the Quad. Well, the United States has been a bit frustrated with India in recent times. India has continued to buy weapon systems from Russia. India has continued to refuse to condemn Russia for the war in Ukraine. The United States started to see India as a little bit of an unreliable ally when it comes to the pressure campaign on China. So the United States has moved to create a new grouping. So at this meeting in Hawaii, they created a grouping called not Quad, but Squad, the Squad. Now, this is interesting because in the U.S. Congress, the term Squad was used to refer to four Congress people who were basically seen as left of center, nothing left of center about the Squad. Japan is in the Squad. Australia is in the Squad. The United States is in the Squad, but India is not in the Squad. India has been replaced by the Philippines. So this squad, this grouping of four, again, is Australia, Japan, the Philippines, and the United States. And this meeting in Hawaii was interesting because it followed a major military drill that these countries had off the coast of China. And also it's important to point out that the Philippines, unlike India, is a mutual defense treaty ally of the United States and is creating a visiting force agreement with Japan. Japan has this kind of treaty with Australia and with the United States. The Philippines already has increased the number of U.S. military bases it has on its northern region. You know, Australia has expanded its military bases to allow the United States to even park nuclear-carrying aircraft. So Japan, Philippines, and Australia are all, in a sense, battleships for the United States. They all have some sort of mutual defense treaty. This is an interaction or this is a unity that's much deeper than the Quad, because India doesn't permit U.S. troops, doesn't have U.S. bases, doesn't have a mutual defense treaty. It's quite an interesting development to see this. It must also be said that the Philippines has expanded its enhanced defense cooperation agreement, which gives the U.S. military access to more and more of its bases. It signed a new comprehensive strategic partnership with Australia. Very dangerous development taking place in the South China Sea. The removal of India, in a way, from this squad is telling. It shows that the United States, in fact, has not only got its foot on the gas in its pressure campaign against China, but it wants to put its foot down. Let's see what happens. It's not really clear what the outcome of this is going to be. But, you know, it's a very chilling moment that there's wars in Europe, wars in the Middle East, and now the United States trying to accelerate towards a war in China at the same time as lots of business leaders are saying this would be a terrible idea. Well, instead of putting all this focus in a conflict with China, what about collaborating with the Chinese to deal with the climate catastrophe? You know who would like that? The Brazilians who are underwater. Tell us about those floods in Brazil.
Well, if people have been seeing the news out of Brazil, they would have seen entire cities, towns, completely underwater due to very heavy rainfall in the southern state of Rio Grande do Sul. At the moment, over 1.3 million people have been affected by the rainfall. There's 497 municipalities in Rio Grande do Sul, and 388 have suffered major issues. So we're talking about a lot of people currently without electricity. 500,000 people don't have power right now. There have been 90 people confirmed dead. There's over 100 missing. Really, really serious situation there. And this is due to very heavy rainfall, as I mentioned, and floods. This has impacted, of course, Rio Grande do Sul in Brazil is the largest rice producer in the country. Preliminary reports say that a lot of the harvesting had been done already, but of course, the storage areas, the fields, a lot of agriculture destroyed. So this, again, this is a serious catastrophe that's taken place in the southern part of Brazil. Brazil has already faced over the past several years similar instances of this, you know, extreme flooding in different states of the country. And of course, many people with reason are pointing to climate change, to environmental deregulation. We know that in a lot of Brazil, the very robust protections that existed, or what there was, or what did exist of environmental regulation and protection to, for example, forests, which are really crucial in stopping in protecting areas and keeping the soil intact. In many, under the Jair Bolsonaro government, a lot of this environmental legislation was slashed, was completely taken, taken down. This has impacted, there's a lot of factors at play when we're talking about how these floods happened that coincided with El Nino phenomenon. But of course, rising temperatures also exacerbate these phenomenons. And of course, the biggest issue is that there's all of these people who have been affected, as I said, over 1 million people. And Brazil, you know, it's been a year and 4 months of Lula da Silva's government. But we know that when Jair Bolsonaro left office, he essentially left a country that had its institutions gutted and destroyed. This means that a lot of people, I think 130 million people that were suffering in some sort of poverty and suffering from food insecurity. So when these sort of disasters happen, of course, when you're a country that is in already these debilitated conditions, it's even harder to recover. Lula da Silva, however, has made several trips to Rio Grande do Sul and has promised federal aid, has already dispatched federal agencies to start working on reconstruction, to deal with the social impacts of this. The environmental ministry is also working on this. So there is a robust federal effort. However, for example, the state's governor, a conservative governor, this has already created some sort of low-level political conflict. And so you know, it's a very, very unfortunate incident. We know that the Landless Rural Workers Movement has a huge presence in this state, and their settlements were also very impacted by the floods. They have started a fundraising campaign to help those affected, not only from the movement, but also raise money to do food distribution. And so the solidarity of the people, you know, in Brazil and also internationally is going to be very crucial in this recovery effort. But as we say, every time these sort of extreme weather occurrences happen, these are becoming more and more frequent. And as neoliberalism is destroying our capacity to actually respond and be able to care for the people, we're having more and more weather catastrophes. But, you know, when you look at the response of a place like Cuba, for example, a small island that has had its economy destroyed, which is in the Caribbean, which faces a lot of these weather phenomenons, you see that it is actually possible for society to organize itself in a way that there can be a people-driven response that takes into the people's needs. We're seeing that is happening on a grassroots level and on the federal level in Brazil. So again, a really tragic occurrence. And unfortunately, because of climate change, things that we'll be seeing more and more over the next several years.
Things we're seeing more and more every year, we see not only climate catastrophes, but workers' strikes. In 2023, there was a wave of strikes that swept through the whole world, whether it was, you know, again, farmers in India or auto workers in the United States and so on, strikes all across the world. Within the last month, there have been a number of strikes in the air industry. In the United Kingdom, there were strikes, not of airline workers directly, but border inspectors, people who look at your passport when you walk across the border. They walked off the job around May Day. In France, there have been stoppages in airlines because of airport strikes. Very interesting strike taking place in India. This is happening with the airline Air India, used to be a national carrier, bought by Tata's, a big multinational corporation. For 2 days now, workers, particularly cabin crew of the Tata Express, on the second day, but the first day, the Air India Express, and on the first day, the regular Air India, cabin crews just didn't show up to work, calling in sick. Hundreds of cabin crew workers just not coming in. And this has brought about 300 planes to a standstill. Very interesting that the workers were able to organize this without management catching a whiff of it. So they couldn't bring in substitute or replacement workers. 300 planes brought down, maybe 2,000 workers were able to communicate with each other. So very unique occurrence, and something that perhaps needs to be studied to see how did the workers do this. They are upset by working conditions. It's very interesting to know that in many airlines, particularly domestic airlines, this is Air India Express, which largely runs domestically. In many countries, from advanced industrial countries to to the new emerging countries, in domestic airlines, airlines don't pay the cabin crew until the aircraft door is closed and the plane starts to reverse. That means that the cabin crew, when they are greeting you at the door, you know, welcome aboard, let me look at your ticket, let me help you with your bag, they are, in fact, unpaid labor. They are not being paid at that point. The smile, you know, that reproductive labor that they have to do, smiling at you, all of that is unpaid labor. They are not paid when they check in at the airport. They are paid when the handbrake is lifted on the plane. These kind of working conditions, they grate on cabin crews. Cabin crews treated as if it's an entirely unskilled job. This is, of course, not true. It's a highly skilled job. You need a lot of training to deal with customers, training to deal with safety, training to deal with, you know, the fact that you have to keep flying all over, you know, serving people during turbulence and so on. But interesting organizing technique, which has not yet been revealed how they were able to do this. But keep in mind, next time you fly, recognize that the workers on the planes, they are not treated by their employer in any glamorous way. There's nothing glamorous about air travel, really. You've been with Give the People What They Want, brought to you by People's Dispatch. That's Zoe today, normally Zoe and Prashant. I'm Vijay from Globetrotter, show number 170. See you next week for 171.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome.